invitation. I'm going to talk about sensitivity analysis for interval-censored discrete failure time data with applications to an AIDS clinical trial group study 181. This is work by my PhD student, Michelle Chardell, and our collaborator, Sam Bozzetti, who is the principal investigator of this clinical trial. So ACTG 181 was used as an illustration by Potensky and Finkelstein in a number of their papers, and it was a natural history study of advanced HIV disease, and there were 204 participants who were scheduled to be monitored for cytomegalovirus shedding in their urine every 4 weeks and in the blood every 12 weeks. For purposes of our analysis today, the shedding time was discretized into 3 month quarters, and there was follow up over a year period, and during this period there was no deaths observed. So at baseline, there were 69 participants were classified as having high CD4 counts, which is a CD4 count of greater than 200 per millimeter cubed, and less than 200 per millimeter cubed. And 135 were classified as having low CD4 counts, which was, so I got that right. But the high is better and low is worse. So two of the research questions in this study were, what is the shedding time distributions for the high and low baseline CD4 groups? And what is the effect of the baseline CD4 count on the risk of shedding? So the challenge with these data are that participants miss their visits, and so we don't have urine and blood measurements on them at every visit. And in fact, it's thought that the missedness may in fact be related to the underlying health status of the individual, which we manifested by their shedding time. So in the data, we actually have a bunch of left censoring of people who were already shedding at baseline. And there was 23% and 36% who were left censored in the high and low groups, respectively. There was 10 to 12% interval censoring, where all we know is their shedding time fell between two of the follow-up times. And then right censored, we knew that they were shedding free at a certain time, then they dropped out and never saw them again. And so their outcome is right censored. And then on the order of 10 to 11% of them are exactly observed, as we knew the exact quarter at which they began shedding. So in terms of just a little bit of notation, there are m equal 4 quarters in which we're looking at, so the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, and fourth quarter. And the shedding time can take on the values 0, which would be that you're shedding at baseline, 1 all the way up to M. And if there was no shedding at 1 year, we put them in a bucket, which we call M plus 1 or 5 in this set situation, which just indicate that there was no shedding during that 1 year period. And we let P sub T denote the probability that the shedding time equals little t. And we denote Z by its baseline CD4 count status, which was 1 for high and 0 for low. So here's the observed data structure that we might get to see on people. That is, at baseline, they might be shedding negative, and then we know that they're shedding negative up until time L, or time prior to time L, and then they miss a bunch of visits, and so we don't know what's going on between L, and then they come back at R, and they're shedding positive. So we don't know exactly where they fell in there. So we've got interval censoring. So in fact, if you were left censored, what you'd see is that L equals 0 and R equals 0. So left and right endpoint. If they were interval censored, L would be less than R. Okay. And if they were right censored, we'd have an L value, and then R would actually be equal to 5. That is, they can fall in any of those other time points. And if they're exactly observed, L would equal R. Okay, so it takes that kind of structure. And so all they get to know is that T falls in L, R. So in work by Heitchen and Rubin in 1991, and in Gill, Vanderland, and Robbins in 1997, they formulated the coarsening at random assumption, which is the typical assumption made in analyzing such data. And the pattern mixture formulation of coarsening at random says that the probability that the shedding time equals little t, given that your left point is equal to little l and the right end point is equal to little r, is equal to the probability that t equals t, given that the shedding time is in l comma r. Okay? And that must hold for all support points t which fall in that interval l comma r. So that's the formal coarsening at random assumption. And the key thing is that the left-hand side of the equation involves both the failure and the censoring processes, whereas the right side involves the failure process only. So you can take the pattern mixture version of this, and you can write this in terms of a selection model, which says the probability that the left point, the left end point equals little l and the right end point equals little r, given the true underlying shedding time, is constant. It does not depend upon the actual time in that interval, just the fact that you're in that interval is constant. So just a few references that are relevant for this talk. There are many more references. But estimation under Carr, Turnbull, 1976, proposed the EM algorithm to estimate the distribution of t. And Tu, Meng, and Pagano, 1993, extended Turnbull's method to discrete-time Cox model. And in Sun, in 1997, talked about estimation of in the continuation ratio model using maximum likelihood. And there are obviously many references I'm leaving out here, so I apologize. But these are the ones that are relevant for this talk here. So first of all, the Carr assumption without auxiliary information is untestable. We can't tell whether coarsening at random is not true or not without getting auxiliary information. Also, what we found in discussions with subject matter experts, Carr is often considered implausible by scientific experts. So for example, our co-author Sam Bozzetti believes that the nature of the missed clinic visits actually relates to the underlying shedding time. So this leads us to, well, how do we present the results of when we don't believe that the Carr assumption is valid? So I'm going to introduce a class of NCAR models, and not Carr models, and we can parameterize this in two different ways. We can put this in the pattern mixture approach, or we can put this in the selection model approach. And this kind of idea of setting up these NCAR models is very similar to the work that was done by Rotnitsky, Robbins, and colleagues. And this is just the extension of that to deal with this more general coarsening pattern. They were working more in a longitudinal framework or survival setting with right sensor data. This is more focused on the interval sensor data context. So what we're going to do is we're going to do exponential tilting here. And so we're going to say that the probability that... I have this one in here. So the probability that the shedding time equals little t, given the left end point equals little l and the right end point equals little r, is equal to the probability that the shedding time equals little t, given the fact that you're in that interval, but exponential tilted by this positive function, e to the q, which depends upon little t, l, and r, and then divided by a normalizing constant to just make sure that this conditional distribution is a proper probability mass function. And this q function is specified by the subject matter expert. Okay, this is something that's specified, it's fixed, it's not something we're going to try to estimate. And this Q function actually indexes these class of models. Okay, indexes these class of models. And note that when Q equals 0, this thing becomes 1. This normalizing constant will also become 1. And what you're left with is Carr. Okay, so we're looking at trying to draw inferences by looking at deviations from Carr, where we elicit information about this. This model index, this censoring bias function from subject matter experts. So you can write this as a selection model. So we can just use Bayes' rule and show that the log of the probability, the left endpoint equals R, L, R equals R, given T equals T, divided by the probability, but given that T is an element of the interval L, R, can be written as some unknown function of L, R, and Q plus Q. Alternatively, you can just write this as looking at the probability of having the interval L, R for a person with whose true underlying shedding time equals little t versus a person whose true underlying shedding time is t prime. And that just becomes the difference of these q functions evaluated at t and t prime. And without loss of generality, we're going to assume that when I evaluate, just for reference, we're going to assume that when I evaluate this q function at little l, it's zero. That's the only restriction we're putting on the q function. And so what's the interpretation of q then? Is interpreted as the log probability ratio of having interval L, R comparing a subject who has their shedding time equals little t versus a person who has their shedding time at the beginning of the interval, little l. Okay, so it's interpreted as the log probability ratio of having interval L, R when you compare a subject who has their shedding time equals little t in the interval versus a person who has the left endpoint of that interval. And clearly, when you set q equals 0, these people have the same exact probability. That's what it says under the selection model. And we get the car back. So we can prove a couple of theorems. I thought I needed to put theorems in for this talk to be able to hang with you guys. So the first theorem says that if I assume either the pattern mixture or the selection model formulation, they're identically equivalent, holds for specified q. So you tell me Q, you write down that selection model. Let's suppose that's true. Then if the probability of exactly observing shedding time at T is greater than zero for all T, then the distribution of T is uniquely identified from the observed data. So you tell me, give me the observed data law, it just has to satisfy that I can at least, that there's a positive probability of exactly observing shedding time at little t, then that will uniquely identify the distribution of t. Secondly, for a specified function q, this uniquely identified distribution up here, in conjunction with our model, yields a joint distribution for L, R, and t, which marginalizes to the observed data law. So this tells me that, basically it tells me that these NCAR models I'm specifying are not testable at all. They non-parametrically just identify the distribution of interest. They're untestable, but assuming this extra regularity condition here. So what this suggests to me is because just like CAR is untestable, these NCAR models are testable, that what one should do in such a setting is to do sensitivity analysis so that to see how robust how your inferences change as you deviate from coarsening at random. And the key here in doing sensitivity analysis is that this Q function can be anything, right? So we need to parameterize it in terms of some low-dimensional parameters that we can talk to subject matter experts about and get their opinions about them. And that's what we do in our analysis. So how do we do inference here? Well, we basically just extend Turnbull's algorithm for the situation. And so we take the probability that the shedding time equals little j on the S iteration of our EM algorithm, can just be written using this equation here. And if I set these exponentials here, the q equals 0, so these go away, that's just Turnbull's algorithm. Okay, so it's just a reweighted version of Turnbull's algorithm that we're doing here to do it when we have this with our model. And then we just do standard errors using Lewis's method. So it's just a generalization of Turnbull's algorithm. So if we're looking at covariate effects, we can look at a continuation ratio model where this is just the hazard of the shedding at time j, given you're at risk at time j. And then this is the continuation model looks at the log hazard divided by 1 minus the hazard is equal to some baseline hazard. Series of j specific, of time specific intercepts, and then you've got your covariate effect there. Again, estimation via the EOM algorithm. Same business. So we did a simulation study to see how this works. We took 100 people per arm. We just had used 4 visits, just like we had in our data analysis. We had the 0-1 treatment or subgroup. And then we do simulations under the fact that there's no covariate effect and one where there's a positive covariate effect. And so the selection, so the censoring bias function we used here was of this form, okay? And where this parameter, there's one for each treatment group, or one for each subgroup, it's a, so e to this, the censoring bias parameter, is the probability ratio of having interval L, R comparing those who shed at the right endpoint of the interval versus those who shed at the left point of the interval. Okay, and we took, in the simulation study, we took 3 different values, one where it's minus log 2. So a minus sign here indicates that people who shed early are more likely to have this interval than people who shed late. 0 means CAR, and log 2 is the opposite. That is, people who shed late are more likely to have this interval. So we do the CAR. So here is no treatment effect and no covariate effect. We do the CAR analysis, but we fit the model with, but we generate data with these true censoring bias parameters. Okay, so we're fitting the CAR is wrong. Okay, and we're fitting. So first one we're fitting in the low group. Let's say 0. We have a minus log 2. Right, that means people at the right endpoint are more likely to be had this interval than left endpoint. And again, similar in the other group. And so there's very little bias here, actually. And the coverage is pretty good. I don't want to give the impression here that if you have equal amounts of bias, I'm sorry, of these Qs parameters in each group, that you're not going to get any bias when you do your CAR analysis. That's not necessarily true. This is very differential censoring between the two arms. Even though the dependence is the same, you still may get bias when you do the CAR analysis. And here's some differential. Here are examples of differential censoring bias in the two arms. And here you see that the bias comes in. Here's another. Here's more extreme differential censoring bias. And again, you see that the there's quite a degree of bias. So now here's where there's a covariate effect, and here just showing when these are the true values of the censoring bias parameters, and I actually fit the right ones, so I'm doing the right thing. And again, there's very little bias here, and the coverage is quite good. So it just shows that the method's doing the right thing. So let's go back to the AIDS clinical trial group 17181 trial. And so we use this kind of funky censoring bias function. But let me give you the interpretation of different parameters. So there's a phi 1, a treatment or a covariate specific phi 1 parameter, and there's a covariate specific phi 2 parameter. So e to the phi 1, okay, is the CD4 specific probability ratio of having interval 3 months to 12 months, comparing those who begin shedding at 12 months to those who begin shedding at 3 months. Okay, so it's comparing what's the probability of having this interval, 3 to 12, for those who begin shedding at 12 months versus those who begin shedding at 3 months. And the phi 2 parameter here is going to be the CD4 specific probability ratio of dropping out. Okay, so there's a bunch of people who drop out just after baseline. Okay, so that's the interval we're talking about, is that all you see them at the baseline, you don't see anything after that, comparing those who do not begin within 12 months, so they're in that N plus 1 bucket, okay, at the end, to those who begin shedding at 3 months. So we actually went to SAM and we elicited this information to him. And it wasn't easy, but he gave us some interesting insight. So the first question we said, we showed him a figure like this. He said, the person comes in, they're negative at baseline, then they miss all these visits, and then they come back at 12 months and they're positive. And we said for the low CD4 count group, who's more likely to have this interval? The guy at 12 months who begins shedding at 12 months, or the guy who begins shedding at baseline? Okay? And he said to us, he said, I think that the guys who are shedding at baseline are more likely, let me just make sure that I'm saying that right. I don't want to misquote Sam. So he said the guys who begin shedding at 12 months are more likely to have this interval than the guys who start shedding at 3 months. And his reason was that this is the low CD4 count arm, and he said it's a mixture of two populations. It's the healthy group in that, you know, the set of people who are closer to 200, and there's a set of people who are closer to, you know, who are really, really worse off. And the people who, the sort of healthy people, they, let me slip ahead here. He says, among participants with high, among the participants with low baseline CD4 count, those who begin shedding within 3 months of testing negative at baseline are less likely to be interval censored than those who begin shedding at 12 months. So he thinks the later guys are more likely to have the interval than the early guys. This is because he believes that the people believe that those with low baseline CD4 count have probably not managed their HIV well, and the least healthy of this group have the greatest motivation to make visits. So the really sick guys are the ones who are making visits. They're less likely to have this interval. The most healthy of this group are likely to shed later. That's why they're more likely to have that interval, and may feel less motivated to comply with this visit schedule. And he felt the same way. We went back and we elicited, we asked the question about dropout. That is, we're now comparing a person at baseline who was negative, then you never see them again, right? So their interval is going to be 3 months all the way up to the last time point. And he also felt that the people here were more likely to have this interval than the people here, who are again shedding here. And so he felt the same way. Here, he says, the people who are shedding within 3 months of testing negative or baseline are less likely to drop out than those who begin shedding after 12 months. And it's because of this mixture of that population of the least healthy and the most healthy, and they're behaving in different ways. And so he felt that these probability ratios were on the order of, you know, of car, which is one, and maybe it's times three times more likely. He did the same thing for the high group. We asked the same kind of questions for the high group, and he felt oppositely. He actually felt the opposite, that it'd be people who shed earlier were more likely to have those intervals than the people who shedded later. And again, it's because of the mixture issue, but he felt it went in the other direction. And so for those parameters, he felt it was between about a third and one. Okay? So what is this actual, what we're doing with this tilting? What does it actually do? Well, under the car, if you had a person who had an interval 3 months all the way up to not shading within 1 year, this is how car would redistribute the probability mass. And what the exponential tilting does in this situation, it shifts that distribution, it tilts that distribution towards higher values. So if we had positive values of these sense and bias functions, it shifts the mass towards higher values. And this is going really extreme. You see, this is moving from 5 to 50 for those guys, and it's becoming more and more extreme. So it's redistributing the mass. So here are some results. Here's the low group, okay, and we fixed so this is taking, this is for each group, we're just fixing at the most extreme values. So the solid line is the car and analysis, and the little dashed lines are the tilting, and the tilting at the most extreme values, and it just moves up a little bit. So it's not very sensitive over the range that we elicited from Sam, but if I took even more extreme values, this thing would shift up even more. Okay, but for the range that he felt comfortable with, it shifts up a little bit. And then here's the the analysis for the high group, and here, because it's the opposite, it shifts down. Again, it's not very much sensitive about that range. But you can see when we do it, when we do our continuation ratio model, when we compare these guys, you see what's happening. This is moving up, this is moving down. So the CAR analysis is going to be it's going to give results that are quite good relative to those with, there might be a treatment effect under CAR, but not a treatment effect under these NCAR models. And so here we fixed the dropout parameters here, okay? And we just do, we take for each treatment group, we vary the interval censoring parameters. This is for the low group, this is the high group. And these are the estimated hazard ratios that you get out from the continuation ratio model. And so this is CAR right up here, which is about 0.624. And then over this range, it goes closer to 1, okay, as you vary over this range. And then when you look at the p-values, you see that under CAR, we reject the null in favor of the high CD4 count. But when you look over these ranges that he considers as plausible, you would actually could fail to reject the null hypothesis. Okay, so the results are obviously very sensitive to the beliefs of our investigator. So my summary is that we presented a formal way of doing sensitivity analysis for informative interval censoring from discrete failure time data. And future directions, we developed a formal Bayesian approach to implement this. We actually elicit priors on those selection bias parameters. What I'd like to do next, but I'm looking for a collaborator, and hopefully there's someone in the audience, is how do I extend this to the continuous time setting and particular focusing on the asymptotic theory and the identifiability issues there? And then how do I incorporate high-dimensional covariates into this analysis? And then further work needs to be done on how you actually communicate with this with experts, and we're starting to gaining a body of experience about how to do that. It's challenging, but I think we'll get better and better at that over time. So that's my talk.